Welcome to the Maria Heller Show. On the net since 2000 and still going strong. If you feel like you're not getting the real news, if you feel like you're not connected spiritually, you have found your home. Maria covers a wide range of topics as only a snarky New Yorker can. Straight up, no chaser. No censorship, no corporate sponsors, thus true freedom of speech. Your subscription gives you unlimited access as a member of the smartest audience on earth. Relax and enjoy the education. Now here's Maria.
Good morning, world. Maria here, alive and kicking. Welcome to the show. Today I have Jonathan Simon back on the show. I know a lot of you are getting more familiar with his work, his excellent work. His book is called Code Red, Computerized Elections and the War on American Democracy. So I'm very happy to have Jonathan back with me. Good morning, Jonathan.
Morning, Maria. Glad to be here and thank you.
Well, you know, this week one of the biggest news stories was Marriott finally admitting since 2014 that their database was hacked and people's passport numbers, personal information, etc. was all stolen. And it took them since 2014 to let people know. So that's a big news story. And of course, when I looked at it, I said, yeah, and they want us to vote online.
Yeah, it's profoundly irrational. If you were designing a system from scratch, you know, to count votes and to keep that core aspect of democracy honest and sacrosanct, the last thing you would do would be to, you know, outsource it to a bunch of private outfits with strong partisan ties, and let them do the programming and maintaining and servicing and distributing and basically have all but complete control over the process, and then, you know, put it in the pitch dark of cyberspace. I mean, now we're seeing, I mean, Marriott is just the latest, but obviously there have been, you know, so many examples of cyber meddling or cyber theft. With vote counting, I mean, the most sort of egregious part of it is that, you know, all we're willing to really look at this point is, well, what if some Russian or some hacker or somebody on the outside, you know, managed to break into this system, you know, call it our electoral house. What if they, you know, jimmied open a window and got in? And we're still at the point where we're completely ignoring, with very, very rare and very tepid, you know, exceptions, we're completely ignoring the insiders who live inside the house, who have been just given this enormous power to alter the course of our, you know, of our country and basically of history.
Well, the first thing I think of when you say that is the state of Georgia, when you had Kemp, you know, in charge of the Elections Commission, and how the vote was stolen in Georgia, to the point where Stacey Abrams now has a lawsuit pending because of all the illegalities that happened in Georgia.
Yeah, I mean, Georgia is you know, poster boy, cesspit for corrupt elections. I mean, it has some good company.
Right.
There are other states as well, but Georgia really stands out. But the problem with Georgia is that, you know, I'm not exactly sure the reasons behind this, but from our standpoint, see, you know, Stacey Abrams is kind of spitting at the wrong spot, or she's spitting at one spot when there are more than one spot that need to be spit at. And that is to say that, you know, what she's been alleging, and there's, God knows, plenty of evidence for it, but she's been alleging all sorts of modes of voter suppression, you know, from just sort of sitting on filed ballot registration, election registrations and absentee ballots and whatnot, various ways of putting a thumb on the scale to prevent voters from being able to cast a vote. And she has every reason in the world to be investigating that, or to be, you know, trying to get that investigated. But at the same time, she's basically made the command decision to ignore, at least so far, the counting process itself and what's going on inside those DREs and those you know, for people who are unfamiliar, the touchscreen voting machines without any paper trail. So there is no paper record. There is no tangible record of votes. It's all in the ether. It's all in cyberspace. And she hasn't pursued that. If I had been advising, you know, that campaign, what I would have asked for immediately, gone to court to get at least one piece and preferably many pieces of voting equipment impounded so that they could be inspected. And by inspected, you know, look at the code that's running on those machines. And I would have gone beyond that and tried to impound the server or servers on which those cards that went into those machines were programmed, because we had very good evidence in the Ossoff Handel election in Georgia 6 that there was a lot of juicy material on those servers. And the way we know that was that as soon as they were subpoenaed, Kemp and his, at the time, the Kennesaw State Election Center, to which he was outsourcing you know, the actual nuts and bolts of running the election, they destroyed the servers. And they destroyed the servers literally within days of the filing and of those suits, and the fact that they knew that those servers were going to be subpoenaed. And they wiped them clean. They degaussed them in such a way, magnetically wiped them clean, so that there would be absolutely no trace of anything left on the servers that were used to program the Ossoff Handel election, which had some of the most blazing red flags statistically and numerically that we've ever seen. So we know the servers in Georgia are a real prime suspect. And, you know, basically Brian Kemp, he oversaw all aspects of this election, which included basically overseeing the programming of the computers that did the counting. So that's where I would want to be looking if I were Stacey Abrams, is, yeah, right, you suppressed a lot of votes, but you got more tools than that in the toolbox, and we'd want to see what happened with the actual counting of the votes.
Right. I mean, I remember the stories, you know, the black seniors on the bus that were stopped from going to the polls, the 700 and plus voting machines that were locked away. You know, the usual, you know, the usual stuff. But it reminded me, you know, back in 2000, when we wanted to have a recount in Florida, and that's when Catherine Harris was in charge, there was no way, because the machines don't give you a receipt. And they said that you can't get a receipt for your vote. But at that time, you know, we were talking about, well, if you go to the bank and you make a deposit, you get a paper receipt right away from the machine.
Yeah, well, but the thing is, even if you had a receipt, it wouldn't help. And this is a common misconception, because, I mean, you know, receipts are not given out because of the ostensibly concerns about vote buying and influencing the casting of votes. If you're going to buy somebody's vote, you would ask for a receipt to see how they actually voted. So, you know, with the secrecy of the casting of the ballot, it's understandable why voters would not get to keep a receipt. But even if they kept their receipts, if you look at it systemically, you know, how would that actually help in a recount process? You'd have to assemble all of the voters in one place and have them basically throw their receipts into a box and then count them by hand. And you know what that is? That's hand counting paper ballots. And you might as well do it on election night, because you're going to have a hard time rounding up and,
Get everybody mailing receipts.
Thousands of voters with their receipts.
Right.
But they're just all sorts. I mean, I guess the overarching point I would make about this is, you know, we're still analyzing this election forensically and trying to figure out what went on. And our forensic tools, you know, exit polls and whatnot, have been somewhat compromised and crippled over the years. So it's getting harder and harder to take this very indirect look. But if you see that somebody like Kemp or Scott Walker or Chris Kobach or, you know, all of these Republican office holders and operatives with control over election processes, and you see them doing these egregiously cynical maneuvers to disenfranchise people, to cut down the electorate and make sure that they can stay in office because the people who would vote against, the most likely to vote against them, are selectively targeted and kept from being able to cast a vote. And then people being that cynical and people being cynical enough to send out flyers that say vote Wednesday when the election is Tuesday and send that to homes of where voters are known to be their opponents, voters of color, urban voters, whatnot. So very much targeted misinformation campaign. And you look at all that, and then you look at the fact that they basically have control of the vote counting process itself, and you're supposed to just rest easy and sleep well on the idea that given that control and given all the other things they're doing, to corrupt the election process and basically thwart the public will, they're not going to avail themselves of the opportunity to directly alter vote counts. That is just, I mean, naive doesn't even begin to describe that mentality. And yet that is what the mainstream media is pitching us, and that is what, by and large, the entire country has accepted, or at least has not organized in such a way as to contest that and to say, wait a minute, this is not good enough. We can't keep getting results in which we have no basis for confidence. And this is very different from the canards about voter fraud and whatnot, which, of course, there's been a lot of research into that. It's been shown to be, all but non-existent. There's very little incentive for individual voters, to try to impersonate another voter and risk an 8-year jail sentence, for voting illegally, like the poor woman in Texas, got 8 years in jail for casting illegal votes. I mean, that doesn't exist. I mean, that's a canard. But when you have control, central control of the counting system in all these counties and all these states, and you are displaying your cynicism in public view by doing all these schemes for disenfranchisement distributing misinformation, closing down polling places, shortening hours, all these things. And that's a very different kettle of fish. And that's right at the core of the process. That's what runs our elections, is the counting process. And we are just absolutely refusing to take a look. Florida, hand count. We hand counted the Senate race, right, because it was within 20.25%, a quarter of a percent, and it's mandated that there's a hand count. So, if you just sort of skim the mainstream media, you get the impression that the Florida race was verified because it was hand counted. Wrong. What was hand counted in Florida were the tiny, tiny sliver of votes that were overvotes or undervotes. Undervotes is where there's no vote recorded for that office, in this case, the Senate. And overvotes are where there seems to be more than one vote, or it's ambiguous. So there's two marks, right?
Right.
That is, about 1% of the votes, less than 1%, and not a random sample. So it's not representative of the votes as a whole. So 99%+ of the votes in Florida were not hand counted, and there was no verification of the machine counts in any county in Florida. And yet we're sort of, again, rest easy. There's this process in place, and we can hand count it. And then you go to an organization like Verified Voting, and I'm sorry, I have a lot of respect for what they're doing, and they're working hard to get rid of purely electronic voting and make sure there's a paper record. All right, step one, fine. But we had paper ballots in Florida. We had no hand count. Florida bans hand counting of all votes that are not undervotes or overvotes. So it bans hand counting of 99% of the votes. So it's not good enough to get rid of the DREs and have paper elections. You have to have processes that are in place that are mandatory for auditing those elections or actually hand counting them. Otherwise, it's no advance. It's no progress.
Right. When you were talking about that woman that got 8 years in prison, and she actually thought she was okay to vote. I thought about...
She was a permanent resident.
All right.
You could certainly see, you know, if you take, oh, I don't know, you know, 1,000 permanent residents, you know, that one or two or three are going to get confused about what their status means. She actually even served as a poll worker. The idea of putting somebody like that, you know, in jail, she's a mother of four children, and, you know, putting somebody like that in jail for 8 years for, you know, basically what was a mistake. And even if it weren't a mistake, I mean, even if you were trying to pull one, you know, pull a fast one, you know, disproportionate punishment, I mean, I actually think that should be appealed further up the line. That was a Texas appellate court that affirmed that 8 year sentence. And, you know, as an attorney, I would look at that and say, you know, there are Eighth Amendment issues here. That is cruel and unusual punishment that does not fit the crime. And I would bring a habeas corpus to federal court using the 14th Amendment and using the Eighth Amendment, because that is outright freaking outrageous.
I totally agree.
And it's designed as absolutely as a strategy to scare the living hell out of anybody else who has any doubts about the legitimacy or the legality of their vote, even citizens who are worried that, oh my God, what if I'm making a mistake? So again, it's another, it's a very, very, you know, like cynical, I guess, doesn't go far enough to describe it. It's a very, very targeted tool of voter suppression, and it's just another one of the thumbs on the scale. If you're going to govern as a minority, if you're going to thwart the will of the people, if you're going to steal, you're going to be corrupt, you're going to do all sorts of things that make you grossly unpopular, but you want to hold on to power, you got to put a lot of thumbs on that scale, and that's what I think we've been seeing.
Right. Well, you know, it's sort of like the IRS right before tax time. You know, they'll bust some celebrity or something to scare everybody else into not messing around with their income tax returns. And I think using this woman was to make people, like you said, who might not be sure, just choose to say, well, I just won't vote.
Right. It's easy enough not to vote. I mean, we have a huge problem with under-participation in the voting process and the electoral process in this country already. I mean, compared to other, you know, Western democracies, you know, a place like Australia compels the vote, and I'm not sure that that is a, you know, something that would ever really play well here, and I'm not sure it's even all that good an idea. But states, even the countries that don't compel the vote, see, you know, voting participation up in the 80s, 70s, 80s, into the 90s, and, you know, we're somewhere around 50. And so we already have problems, and people feel, for a whole variety of reasons, make a choice not to vote. Very often it's because they have the kind of jobs where they can't get off, and they absolutely, or they have child care issues. And, of course, that disproportionately affects voters at the lower end of the economic spectrum, i.e., you know, the voters who would vote for Democratic, progressive, liberal candidates. So it's part of what has kept the United States so much of an outlier politically among Western democracies. And really, you know, I mean, even in countries where there are supposedly, you know, right-center governments like Germany and stuff, if you just look at the provisions in their states, what they call right-center, we would call, you know, to the left of George McGovern. And, you know, we're just in a completely different universe as far as that stuff goes. And one reason is the voter participation rates.
Right. But, you know, when I look at that, I think of several things, Jonathan. Number one, we never get to pick the candidates. Okay. This last presidential election was the worst choice I've ever seen in my life. Okay. So a lot of people get turned off. And then the other thing is, a lot of people that have lived long in this country realize nothing changes. You know, there's no real improvement for we the people. That's the third one. And, you know, way back when I was in high school in the 60s, when we learned about the Electoral College, the first thing I said to my teacher was, well, what's the point of voting?
Yeah, you're not going to get much of an argument from me on that. I mean, look, you know, you set up a country. It's hard to have 200 years plus of foresight, you know, in 1789 in deciding how you're going to set up a constitution. And I would have to say the founders, given their interests and given the fact that they were mostly, you know, representatives of the elite, many of whom were slaveholders, et cetera. I mean, they are what they were. And given that, they showed a great deal of enlightenment, and they showed a great deal of brilliance in giving you know, a new country, a very experimental country, a very strong constitution. So, you know, in that sense, the glass is half full. They did a lot of you know, very enlightened things and very showed a lot of foresight. However, you know, we are now an old democracy, really, in many ways, the oldest, you know, existing democracy, if you want to call it a democracy anymore. You know, and we're a bit sclerotic, and there are things that unintended consequences. For instance, you know, in the U.S. Senate, 82% as of the 2010 census, 82% of the population is represented by half the senators, and the other half of the senators represent 18% of the population. And, you know, they've begun to sort of look at this and say, well, you know, that was intentional in a sense on the part of the founding fathers, but it's gotten somewhat out of hand. And it would be very difficult, given that setup in the Senate, for Democrats ever to regain the majority. If they own, you know, they might come close in 2020, but that's a huge tilted table in favor of the small rural states. And so, you know, that's
right.
One of the systemic problems. The Electoral College is another one. But you look at an election like 2018, and one of the things that still has me scratching my head about the you know, what actually happened in the counting process, is you had this enormous explosion of turnout. I don't have the exact number, but it was a spike increase of, I think, something in the neighborhood of almost 40% over the turnout in the last midterm election, 2014. I'd have to go back and check that, but it was enormous. I mean, we had,
right, this was the biggest one for a midterm ever.
114, something like that, million votes, as opposed to 80 million votes. Now, it's conventional wisdom, you know, in America, that Republicans turn out at a higher rate, you know, voters that select Republican candidates, right, to the right of the spectrum, turn out at a higher rate than their left-wing counterparts. They are consistent voters. They don't move around very much. They have a tendency to, you know, own homes and be wealthier, be older, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a lot of demographic reasons and cultural reasons why they already were turning out at a high rate, which means they had a ceiling. The Republican voters were already voting. So who were these 40 million additional voters? You know, unless Republicans were voting twice or three times, the vast majority of them were Democratic voters, part of the Democratic constituency, a huge upsurge. And it's very obvious why. I mean, it's response to Donald Trump and
right.
response to Brett Kavanaugh and response to this two, you know, so far 2 year nightmare for a lot of people, including
right.
many of those people in red states who are getting economically screwed, who believed that Trump would come in and somehow, you know, make their lives better. And with his trade wars and whatnot, he is not, in addition to being, you know, fundamentally a grotesque as a representative of our country with his tweets and his constant, you know, derogation of just about everybody.
Right.
It's this provoked an enormous you want to call it backlash or, you know, just a...
I would call it a backlash. I mean, when you look at what they voted for, and this is probably the most diverse House we've ever had. Women, yeah. Native Americans, Muslims, gay people. And then you compare it to the Senate. And, you know, I want to go back to what you said about our founding fathers and the Constitution. You know, real history hurts. And when you look at the founders and the people that put the Constitution together, it was really to protect the rich white male landowner. And when you look at the Senate, that's who you have sitting there. There's no diversity in the Senate.
No, they're all basically all millionaires and multimillionaires. And, you know, again, Paul Simon, a loose affiliation of millionaires and billionaires in his most brilliant song I think ever written, The Boy in the Bubble. Loose affiliation of millionaires and billionaires. These are the days of miracle and wonder.
Right. And then you look at that Puerto Rican girl from New York, Ocasio.
Yeah.
And how they're ripping on her for her clothes, for her worn down shoes, because she can't afford an apartment there.
Yeah.
But my thought is she truly represents the 99% of us. And it bothers the wealthy guys that, you know, somebody's in there to shake it up. And she really isn't taking any crap from any of them.
No, she isn't. And, you know, and then, of course, that sets up this storyline about how the Democrats can't get their act together. And that is why they will always wind up losing. It's just, you know, somehow, and I don't know if it's just because we're more savvy about it or it's actually, in fact, changed. And I believe it's a combination of both. We are more savvy than we were in the 60s and 70s, but it has also changed tremendously with the advent of, you know, the Rush Limbaughs of the world, the Newt Gingriches of the world, the Karl Roves of the world. These are some very, very driven people. And, you know, in previous times in history, when people have been driven like that, usually what they've done is they've staged a coup when they've, you know, rolled tanks down the main street of the Capitol, or they've done whatever, you know, Mussolini and Hitler did. In this case, it's happened through the perversion of the protocols of standard politics. But it has been no less effective as a coup. And what it's become is, you know, you can call it euphemistically a zero-sum game, which doesn't sound all that bad. But basically, it's a take-no-prisoners war to the death. And they're not going to give up power. And the moneyed interests are not going to give up power. And unfortunately, you know, they have an enormous advantage of being a lot more centralized than the public at large. The public at large is dependent on... now, information networks that are increasingly under the control of those same moneyed interests. I mean,
absolutely,
90% of the newspapers are owned by six corporations.
Mm-hmm.
So, for the public as a whole to organize is a tall order. Because
I don't know, Jonathan. I don't know if you followed, you know, because I know you're busy, you know, checking on this election. But, you know, the people of France set Paris on fire this week, literally. They came out and protested in their yellow jackets against the fuel hike, tax on the fuel. They set Paris on fire. The firemen turned their backs to Macron. And this morning, Macron has reversed that tax.
I know. I saw that he, I mean, you know, I'm surprised he held out as long as he did.
So, right. Kind of makes you wonder, what are Americans waiting for? I mean, supposedly, if we buy the history of this country, it was the French that gave us so much of our, you know, thoughts on freedom, the Statue of Liberty, the whole nine yards. What are Americans waiting for to say enough? Are they waiting for the bombs to go off?
You know, I don't know. I've been asking myself that question, you know, along with you, I'm sure, I've been asking myself that question for quite some time. I really thought there would be a rising up. Well, there was. After the 2000 election, I was at the inauguration for Bush, and there were somewhere between 60 and 100,000 of us there, you know, plenty angry. We outnumbered the supporters about, you know, more than 10 to 1. We were rounded up. We were kept off camera. We were sequestered into these little, they cages. Let us into these cul-de-sacs and then blocked us in and wouldn't let us out. They had helicopters up there. And, you know, this was all basically under the transitional administration. Still, you know, Clinton was still in the White House at that point, up to the day of the inauguration. So all this had to be planned cooperatively between Democrats and Republicans. And they basically made us disappear. And I think, you know, when Bush wanted to go to war in Iraq, again, there were, you know, there was, we were in that at those protests. At that time, I was in New York City, and there were literally a million of us. I mean, it was, you know, around the world on a single day, over 10 million people came out in the streets and said, do not invade Iraq. And Bush very, you know, infamously, but brilliantly, probably said to him by Karl Rove, who was Bush's brain at the time, well, that would be making policy, like, that would like be making policy based on a focus group, he said.
Hmm.
And he just ignored it completely and went into Iraq. And I think that was a big turning point because, you know, people figured, well, if 10 million of us could come out and we're all these enormous protests and, you know, we actually made it sort of onto TV and onto CNN and whatnot, and he could just wave us aside as if we were a quote-unquote a focus group.
Right. Maybe it should have been 100 million. Maybe it will be 100 million next time.
You know, what's the point? So I think there was a kind of, at that point, people, you know, from that point on, and that was before he invaded Iraq, and then he goes and he invades Iraq and all sorts of Abu Ghraib and all sorts of ugly, ugly, ugly things go on.
Right.
And there was never any protest again.
No.
I mean, there were, you know, 50 people would get together and, you know, march down some side street someplace. But there was never that kind of massing again. Then you had Occupy. People got out there. They actually got out there and they stayed out there. It was tenacious. It was sustained. But again, it got infiltrated. And one day, under the Obama administration, they decided, okay, this is, you know, getting a little too hot. And in one weekend, they basically cleared the streets using, what, safety, public safety as a pretext.
Right.
They coordinated a blitzkrieg, and they swept everybody, you know, up off the streets. So when things like this happen, I think it leads the public to feel, just like you said, you know, when you read about the Electoral College as a kid, you know, what's the point? What's the point? We don't have the power. And, you know, I don't know what it would look like if this country rose up, you know, in the manner of France. It could get pretty, pretty scary. Although, you know, how much more scary can it get than what we got going now?
I totally agree.
You know, I've advocated for the use of economic power. At this point, I mean, you know, just the enormous power we have as consumers to say no. Now, it's historically been difficult to organize that power. But, I mean, that's nonviolent resistance that hits the corporations where it absolutely hurts. I'm not buying that iPhone. I'm not buying that flat-screen TV. I'm not buying that Instapot. I'm not buying that new car. I'm not buying those designer jeans or those designer sneakers or whatever. I mean, we have this enormous power to bring a capitalist system to its
exactly.
Needs.
You know, years ago, I totally agree. Listen, we have to take a short break, so we'll come back on that thought in a minute. Stay with us.
Okay.
Hi, this is Maria. I don't often get to talk directly to the listeners here on the Gary Noll Network, but I felt like doing that today. I know a lot of you really enjoy my show, but you might not know that I do 4 shows a week over at my website, maria.net. So if you're loving the show you get to hear on Sunday, come on over to my site and subscribe, because I've got hundreds of hours of great shows on pretty much every topic in the universe. And that again is maria.net, M-E-R-I-A.net. And now we can get back to this excellent show. Thanks. Okay, I'm back live with Jonathan Simon. His book, Code Red, Buy 10, Give Them Out to Everybody You Know, Computerized Election and the War on American Democracy. You know, Jonathan, when you were talking about, you know, how we could bring the system down, many years ago, Lordy B, it had to be maybe 2006, I don't remember. I had Catherine Austin Fitz on the show on the 4th of July. And what she was doing was a new movement to take our money out of the big banks, which would be a great way to bring them all down. You know, and I've been telling my listeners for 20 years, you vote with your dollars. That's the only vote you have that counts. So at that time, I was banking with Bank of America, and I actually had money in the bank at that time. And I went in there, and listen, I'm sure you can tell I have a very loud voice. I demanded to take my money out of the bank. And they called the bank manager over, and she was like, oh, Miss Heller, did we do anything wrong? Weren't you getting the service you want? You know, they treat you different when you have a few bucks in the bank.
Absolutely.
And I let her have it, okay? I let her have it, from B of A money laundering to replacing these kids' jobs. At that time, they were doing fingerprint sign-ins on your account, which I refused, and I blasted her. She did not respond to me at all. All she did was tell the kid behind the counter, give her her check. And what was interesting is when I took it to my credit union, which I recommend people, you know, bank locally, yep, or in a federal credit union, at least they're self-insured, unlike, you know, the FICA, which is broke and has been. When I went in there, the kid looks at the check and he looks at me and he's like, why'd you leave Bank of America? And I went into my whole speech all over again. Well, he ended up calling all the other tellers over. Listen to what this lady has to say. Okay, so I'm very cautious where I spend my money. I've never, the only store I have in my town is Walmart. I've never spent a dollar there and never will. But people need to realize they don't care how much you protest in the street if they have your money.
I couldn't put it any better than that. And, you know, again, I've been so frustrated. I mean, I guess, you know, as angry as I ever get at Karl Rove or, you know, similar to Roger Stone, you know, the Voldemorts of the world, they're basically doing their job. I mean, I make this point in Code Red. I mean, that's their job. Their job is, they're operatives, and they're paid by the win. And they're doing what evil people do. Mm-hmm. But they are tremendously outnumbered by good people. And they're tremendously outnumbered even by, you know, activists and operatives on our side, on the side of you know, of fairness and,
right,
fair distribution and the environment, right, and all that. And I get angrier at the people on our side than I can ever get at Karl Rove.
Because they don't realize
the frustration of putting things in front of them that make, you know, either I'm insane or something's wrong with them. Because you look at things and you say, look, you know, here's the picture, here's the situation, like, just like you're looking at it, you know.
Do the math. I tell people, do the math.
These are the weapons. This is what we're up against. This is what we should consider doing. And can we please get somebody who, you know, it has some megaphone? Can we please get somebody with some organizing ability to start doing these things that actually have throw weight, that have some impact, that involve money? No, you know, let's go out and have a march. Let's go out and wear pussy hats. Okay, that's great. But you've got to, you know, it dies there.
The only place you can hurt, listen.
And it dies there, and then people feel good about it and wind up living in almost exactly the same world that they were before. And, you know, it's like you've
got
to be committed. Because, you know, the Scott Walkers of the world, they're committed. They lose an election, and they don't waste 24 hours before they're in there in the lame duck session trying to eviscerate the power of the incoming members that have been voted in by the people to displace them. They are committed. Mm-hmm. I mean, whatever else you think of them, they are willing to pull out every
stop and
go to the mat and not, you know, not sleep at night to make these things happen.
Absolutely.
And we are not. And that's a big part of the story of what's happened in this country, is the level of commitment and the level of strategic understanding, and tactical understanding is just really woefully inadequate.
Well, I agree.
So we're the majority, but we're being ruled.
Well, listen, I often remind my listenership that we have numbers on our side. So if you've got, you know, 30 to 300 families running this world, and you've got 7.5 billion other people on the planet, do the math. But maybe that's my New York, Brooklyn attitude. But, you know, before the show, you and I talked, and we do have good news. I mean, I've been covering this stuff since 2000. But this morning, there are huge protests in front of the Capitol in Wisconsin against what the GOP is trying to do to the incoming elected person. You look at the exposure in North Carolina of everything that went wrong there, where they're actually talking about another election, redoing the election. People have become very aware, much more aware than they were 20 years ago, of how they keep stealing these elections and are at least beginning to get verbal about it. Maybe by 2050, we'll have honest elections in this country. But we have, you know, I know sometimes you get really frustrated. I do too. But we've made a difference because people are more aware. And again, I'm going to tell people, you know, if you're still banking in one of the major banks, number one, they're all going to crash just like they did in 2008. Get your money out now. Stick it in your mattress if you don't want to use the Federal Credit Union. Learn about the stores, businesses, franchises you're having dinner at, buying your sweatshirts at. And how they treat their employees. What are they paying their employees? How much are you subsidizing their employees with food stamps, etc., because they're not making a living wage? All we have to do is stop spending. That's all we have to do. Stop spending, take your money out of their banks. What would they do?
Yeah, it's our strongest power. I mean, you look at the kind of power we have as a public. I mean, one is voting, and we've seen that be corrupted. So it's like if voting is our voice, our voice has been garbled. It's garbling our voice and making it come out not what goes into the microphone is not what comes out. The
garbled? Our voices have laryngitis.
Laryngitis. I mean, it's worse than garbled.
Right.
So that voice is gone. But then we have strength as workers, we have strength as taxpayers, and we have strength as consumers. And if you look at, you know, general strikes, when things get bad enough, those have been, you know, something that in other places of the world and occasionally in
I'm all for general strikes.
US, that's worked, but it's a big major step, and it can have a lot of collateral damage coming out of that. Same thing with, you know, withholding taxes. Yes, you provoke a crisis, but our power not to spend, in many ways, is the most powerful of all and the most benign in terms of who it actually hits. And if you want to bring legislation, let's say, to a state to have hand-counted paper ballots, at this point, quite frankly, I mean, we're not going to get it from the federal government. There are constitutional reasons involved, but more than that, there are political reasons involved. We're not going to get it from the federal government. Forget it. None of these bills is going to pass with any strength to them at all. So it's going to have to go state by state. So if you want to go to a state and you want to get hand-counted paper ballots or you want to get risk-limiting audits, some protocol that actually in a publicly observable way verifies the vote counts, you really have two alternatives at this point. And one is ballot measures. And we saw a very strong, stronger than what we've seen in the past, ballot measure passed in Michigan, providing for audits. They're very popular. The public likes them. I mean, what's not to like?
Right.
In putting a little transparency into our elections. So, you know, that passed in Michigan, and of course, a lot of redistricting, anti-gerrymandering ballot measures passed again. Very popular.
Right.
And so you could get a ballot measure to either mandate hand-counted paper ballots or mandate risk-limiting audits or some hybrid of the two, and get that on the ballot, get it funded, get some, you know, get a little PR behind it, get Tom Steyer or somebody like that into the act to provide some financial support for such a thing, and probably get it passed. Now, granted, it would be voted on these same machines that you're trying to eliminate, or you're trying to take the power away from them. So they would be very high targets, high profile targets for rigging. But again, if you had enough information out about this, and it was as popular as it probably should be, you know, you might well have rig-proof margins of 75% to 25%, something like that.
Right.
You would at the very least get the issue into the public discourse, get it debated, get it out there, get information out there about it. This would be profoundly big step forward. And it's one that, you know, I find myself kicking myself that we really weren't pushing 10 or 15 years ago, ballot measures. And at that time, we thought we could get legislation. Some of us didn't, but the majority feeling among election integrity advocates was that we could get legislation passed eventually. Well, we were wrong about that. Mm. So we should have been focusing on ballot measures. We could still do that. We could actually get ballot measures on in time for the 2020 election. And so that's one avenue. But if that, for whatever reason, is thwarted, for instance, right now in Missouri and I think also in Ohio, it's not a lame duck state legislature, it's the Republican state legislatures, they were appalled at the fact that ballot measures passed to limit redistricting, you know, and try to stop gerrymandering. So they're putting into the law measures to make it more difficult, verging on impossible, to amend the state constitution, which would be what one of these ballot measures would be doing. It would be amending the state constitution to conduct the elections with hand-counted paper ballots, let's say. So they're trying to thwart that. So if that were thwarted, you know, in a given state, and you couldn't, obviously you're not going to get the legislation out of those legislatures, and these are key states, these are key swing states, places like Ohio, places like Michigan, places like Wisconsin, Florida, North Carolina, et cetera, Missouri. These are key Texas. These are key states, and they're controlled by Republicans. You're not going to get the legislation. If you're thwarted in the ballot measures, then what really is left is organizing a consumer action to say to the corporations, here's a list of things that we are not buying. And, you know, wouldn't take 100% of the people, 10% of the people.
Right. Would hurt them big time.
They weren't buying. I mean, when corporations see their bottom line go down by 2%, there is panic in the corporate boardroom. I mean, we are a consumer capitalist country. We are absolutely dependent on the good, you know, the cooperation of consumers in doing their part. Two-thirds of our economy, of our GDP, is consumer, domestic consumption.
And that's one thing that really, really, really bothered me, you know, and I noticed it more with Bush W., the idiot king, as I called him, who now he's being, you know, made a saint because of the comparison to Trump.
Go shopping, he said.
Right, like his father is now getting sainthood. But at that time, they started referring to us not as citizens anymore, even the media. We were referred to as consumers.
Consumers, yeah.
And I found that very insulting. All right, it wasn't that we're citizens anymore. We're just consumers. You know, when you look at those protests at the Wisconsin Capitol this morning, it amazes me how fast the people there woke up to what Scott Walker, who's backed by the Koch brothers, is trying to do. And they're actually out there screaming, this is a coup, honor our vote, you're crippling our democratic power.
Yeah, I mean, I should say they've been protesting in Wisconsin for the last, at least 6 years. there are a lot of protests at the State House. I actually
participated at least they're awake
in several of them when I was there to deal with the theft of previous elections in Wisconsin. It's definitely stepping up, and they're definitely getting stronger. But Wisconsin is Georgia is a poster child for stolen elections. So is Wisconsin. And it's a poster child for what, you know, a cynic like Walker can do. I mean, in destroying the power of the unions, thwarting what was once a very progressive state, you know, Bob La Follette. It's pretty ugly. However, I mean, these politicians from Walker on down, they're owned by the Koch brothers. They're owned by these corporations.
Exactly.
If these corporations start panicking because an effective boycott or consumer action has taken a bite out of their bottom line, they're going to go to those office holders that they own, and they're going to say, yeah, meet these demands, get this legislation passed. And that's one of the other, you know, it's the other vector, you know, conduit by which we could get to honest, public, observable vote counting. Neither one of which is, I got to say, you know, neither the ballot measure or this economic action approach is an easy road. But, you know, until somebody, but the legislative road is blocked. The bridge is out. Mm-hmm. You're not going to get to the other side of the river. So you should not even bother going down that road.
Well, it goes back to what I said earlier, though. We don't pick the candidates, and the people that pick the candidates never lose. Okay, they pick both sides. And I think about the Collier brothers in 1973. And one of the things that I'll never forget that stuck out in my mind in their book, Vote Scam, was this sentence. And I don't know if you've heard it before, Jonathan, but they said, you can't vote the bastards out because you didn't vote the bastards in.
Yep.
And to me,
it's
that's
a great book.
Right.
It was years, decades ahead of its time.
Absolutely. And when you look at that, you know, that's the only explanation I can give for Congress retaining their jobs when they're in the single digit approval numbers.
Yeah. I mean, I've made the point in Code Red that, you know, primaries are the lowest hanging fruit. I mean, they're the easiest races to rig because, you know, there's the least scrutiny. There's generally, you know, in the vast majority of cases, no exit polls. There isn't even a whole lot of pre-election polling. There's very, you know, relatively low voter turnout, relatively low interest, relatively low coverage. I mean, you can steal those races, you know, a bushel at a time. You know, whether that's what's happening, I mean, there are other factors involved. There's obviously, big influence of big money in politics. Mm-hmm. But I have to say that if you look at all those quote-unquote organic factors, you know, campaigning and campaign strategies and money and whatnot, they just, you know, sometimes you can just look at a picture and you have all the numbers and you have all the charts and you have all this evidence. And, you know, when you look at it, it's like a Puntillist painting. You know, you got all these little dots. But if you step back 3 or 4 feet, you can recognize the image. And I've said that our elections in this country is like Munch's meets Seurat. It's like a Puntillist painting, Puntillist version of the Scream. And you don't see it unless
Scream.
You step back about 6 feet and you look at the whole canvas and it's like, there it is. And, you know, that's part of the frustration because that's what we've been seeing for years and years and providing the evidence of, and you cannot get the New York Times, you cannot get...
No, they won't cover the truth because they get paid by the same people. Well, they get paid by the same people. You know, they're told what we're allowed to hear.
It is very, very restricted in terms of what you can do. And, you know, look, I mean, you got to have, in a way, they're fighting part of the good fight. In standing up, if you take something like the New York Times, they're standing up for a lot of good things, and they're calling out a lot of bad things, but there is this, you know, macula. There is this blind spot that is right at the core that involves our elections, and we're, you know, out there on the fringe saying, hey, pay attention.
Look. We've been on the fringe for 20, 30 years, but it's making a difference, which is probably why I just got my current 30-day ban on Facebook. That makes three. That makes three in 4 months.
Congratulations is all I can say, you know, it means you're doing something right.
That's what everybody else says. So, Jonathan, we only have a few minutes. I want to ask you something, because I can hear your passion. I can hear your patriotism, if that's the right word. You've been at this a long time. Why do you continue to do this?
Well, I think it's probably... you probably know the answer because it's probably the same reason you continue to do it. I'd have to say, you know, it's maybe it's in our DNA that we don't want to be bystanders. You know, that the last thing we could tolerate is just sitting there going back to, you know, life's little pleasures and watching this just epochal, you know, absolutely epochal crime taking place. It's like watching, you know, Kitty Genovese in the courtyard getting stabbed.
Oh, God, I remember that story. Right.
And, you know, and you've got to, you know, and we've tried calling 911. We've done that. We've called 911. You know, and at some point that's not even enough. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I don't particularly, I don't enjoy this. My main interest in life has to do with mind, body, and health related
I understand.
Aspects of how the body actually works. I mean, that's what my formal, I'm an attorney, I was a chiropractor. I'm fascinated by that aspect, how we breathe, how we balance, how we bear our weight, how that affects our emotional state, how that affects our physical state, our longevity. That's what I'd really like to be spending my life on. But this is just such a crisis that is having such, you know, universal effect on this planet. I mean, it's not just this county, this state, this congressional district, whatever. It's the direction and policy of our country. And by extension, really, the history of the world is balanced on the nose of this electoral seal. And we are just not taking care of that. And to just, you know, throw in the towel and say, well, tra-la, you know, nobody cares. So we're not, it's just not, I'm just not wired that way.
I think you said it best. I think it's in our DNA. Who knows? Maybe we were one of the first revolutionaries in this country all those years ago. Maybe we're reincarnated versions of them.
It could be. And I mean, you know, we tend to think because we're such an established democracy and we have such a history and all that, that, you know, that it doesn't need any more revolutionaries and it doesn't need any more
vigilance. We need it now
more
than ever.
That's a terrible mistake.
Absolutely. We need it now more than ever. And I want to thank you for being who you are and doing what you do, because you support me and I support you. It makes me feel less alone.
I feel just the same way. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much, Jonathan, and I look forward to talking with you again.
Let's do it again. There'll be plenty more material.
Oh, I'm sure of that. All right, you take good care.
Take care, Maria.
Bye. Bye-bye. Jonathan Simon, a real patriot. And listen, I don't even think it's about just this country. Like he said, it's the whole world. And if it's in your DNA, which I know it is for my listeners, because you guys support the work, you share the work, you buy the books, it makes me feel less alone. And that's part of why I continue doing the show, so you guys don't feel alone either. So anyway, there you have it. Think about every dollar you spend, okay? My sister's always ragging on me saying I'm frugal. I'm not frugal. I'm careful. There's a difference. Anyway, thanks again for listening to the show, and I'll see you guys next time.
Thank you for listening and supporting The Maria Show. Tell others what you learned today. Knowledge becomes wisdom only when it's shared. Encourage others to subscribe today. www.maria.net. Often imitated, never duplicated. A world of information all in one place. www.maria.net. Always ahead of the curve. Always on your side. Get active or get radioactive. Subscribe today.